Welcome to Innovation Hub. I'm Kara Miller. Last year, the number of female Fortune 500 CEOs hit an all-time high, around 3.2%. Not too impressive, given that women comprise just about half of the workforce. So what's going on here? Are women themselves shunning the corporate climb, or are they being judged unfairly in the workplace? To answer these questions, I'm joined first by Betsy Myers, the founding director of the Center for Women and Business at Bentley University. Betsy Myers, thanks very much for being here.
Great. Thanks, Kara.
So let me just start with that. Why are 97% of Fortune 500 CEOs men? And I should say, if you expand it out and look at not just the 500 biggest companies, but about the 3,000 companies that are publicly traded, it's almost exactly the same numbers. About 3% of CEOs
right.
are women.
And we haven't made much progress in the last 15, 20 years, which
That's right.
pretty stunning, actually. I think it's an issue that we're all trying to figure out, and there's no easy answers to it. Here's the secret code. Well, what's exciting right now is that corporate America, many of the companies are saying, wait a minute, the workforce has changed. 70% of new entrants into the workplace last year were women and people of color. And, wow, our customers are women. 85% of spending is by women. And so how can we do better with this? And so there's this change of conversation because they're mostly male CEOs are saying, what are the things we need to do to keep our women in the pipeline? Because that's where, why do we have this leaky pipeline? So that we can have more candidates to be CEOs. And that's the shift in conversation that's going on.
And we do see now more law school grads, more
yes.
college grads are women. So you talk about a leaky pipeline. What accounts for the leaks in the pipeline?
Well, I think, women are it's a lifestyle in corporate America. And I think Anne-Marie Slaughter's article at The Atlantic was so telling. And I actually agreed with everything she said, which is there's a certain point where women say, wait a minute, I'm a whole human being here and working 60, 70 hours a week to get up the pipeline when I have a family or other things. And here's the thing, too. It's not just about women having children. It's about having a whole life because men, too, say, wait, I have issues. I have aging parents. I have a child that has needs. I have other things in my life. And so often we as women, our whole being and our whole self-esteem isn't based totally on our job, that we actually have things outside of the job that give us our kind of our self-esteem and who we are. And so women are opting out to not leave completely, or sometimes we'll leave a couple years, starting their own businesses, choosing a lifestyle that allows them to be able to maybe raise a family or have a life outside of the workplace.
Let's jump right into that Anne-Marie Slaughter discussion. We actually have a clip of her. She's a professor at Princeton who famously wrote in The Atlantic just very recently that women still can't have it all. And here she is actually reacting to the news that Marissa Mayer was named the CEO of Yahoo and is also going to be having a baby in October. And she's on Meet the Press's Press Pass. Let's listen to her.
I think it's terrific, and I applaud her. And any woman who makes it to the top, I applaud. I want more women at the top. But I actually think she confirms a lot of what I was saying, because I actually say women who are superhuman, rich, and in charge of their own time can do it. It's just that that's kind of a very high bar. And I don't think it makes sense to say to most women, make CEO by 37 and then have kids. For most women, they're having kids before then. They need to take time. We need more flexible arrangements. But mm-hmm. I'm all for what she achieved. I just don't think that it applies to the majority of women.
I'm also joined by Judy Shenfilman, principal and founder of Dreambridge Partners, and Lottie Balin, professor emeritus at MIT Sloan. And Judy Shenfilman, make sense a little bit of Marissa Mayer getting to be CEO of Yahoo. What did you think when you heard it?
Well, I think in terms of for her, if this is what she wants and this is what thrills her, all the power to her. That's fantastic. And I think some other women may say, this is not exactly what I'm looking for. So I think all of us need to applaud and celebrate those people that get to a position like this at a very great young age of 37, and she chooses to have a baby during that time. And if that works for her, we should all be celebrating that. And for a man that says, I don't want that, that's also okay. What we have to recognize to what you were talking about is that corporate America has a culture, and that culture has a history. that happens to be in the United States. If you look at in the United States, what does culture of power look like? It is a Caucasian male that is a really has given everything up in his life in the pursuit of the cause. That's really what we still think heroism and culture of power looks like today.
That's what the CEO looks like.
The corporate CEO, right? And it's really today still, if you look at it, it's the pyramid with the one person at the very, very top that's make all the decisions. And the reality of most of the world today is that we're in matrix organizations with multiple people making decisions. And so what happens then is it does take a particular type of person who's going to want to make it. And the reality is, given the way that our society is changing, given the way that cultural expanse is happening in the world, we have to rethink of what does really, really powerful people who are going to make truly great executive decisions look like. It happened maybe a woman, but I also challenge that there's an opportunity for us to look at different ways of making decisions. That may be that rather than having a pyramid, we look at trapezoids. Maybe there are more ways to have women that are in. So I really do challenge for all of us to use the word opt out. What I say is that companies have not allowed women and those that choose to have a different lifestyle to opt in. And therefore, it is a great loss on the part of corporate America to not be maintaining those with the highest talent. So then what you're left with is those that are willing to deal with this kind of perspective of ascension and power. This is why almost half of all small businesses are run by women. Right? We account for almost 18 million workers, up to $3 trillion in revenues. And what's interesting for women that are starting businesses, they're 40 to 46, which means they've actually gone up their career ladder, have a lot of experience, and for some interesting reason, they decide, I'm going to go out on my own. So I think we need to really look at that as we move forward.
And maybe they have older children who are now able to do more on their own, and they can finally...
Exactly. And so they're opting in to still pursue their dreams and their careers, but in a different configuration.
Lottie Balin, I can see that you want to get in here on this question of workplace culture.
I want to continue on what we've been talking about, that there's no reason that I can see why a CEO necessarily does the best work by being always at the workplace, by being always accessible. And though that is the culture, that's the culture we know, and I think we have to challenge that. In fact, we know that if managers or leaders or CEOs are too much on top of everything, it's a detriment to the people who are actually doing the work, that being a little bit away and apart from surveillance allows people to make the decisions at lower levels, which is where usually the information lies, where decisions should be made. So I think we need to think about the culture, we need to think what we need in leaders, and we need to think how the work is organized. And I think it's not only a problem for women, but it's also a problem for men. And when we talk about women have choice, they can start a small business, what that means is that the men in their lives don't have that choice. And we need to create both a culture and a workplace where people can have these kinds of choices. And that means that we have to rethink very systematically the way we think that work needs to be done, the way we think that leaders need to behave. And if we're willing to challenge some of those very taken-for-granted assumptions and to begin to make some changes, I think everyone will benefit, not only the employees, but the business itself.
I want to get back to that question of corporate culture in just a minute. Let me say, though, that I'm Kara Miller, and we are talking about women and business and why they are only 3% of CEOs. And we're joined on the line by Sridhari Desai, a research fellow at Harvard's Kennedy School and assistant professor at the University of North Carolina. Sridhari Desai, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So you've done a really, really interesting study about the way that married men, so you really focused on men here, the way that they look at women in the workplace. And before you sort of get into what you found in the study, which is striking, what inspired you to want to do the study in the first place?
So I was raised in India, and I noticed that in India we have a very strong tradition where often women are sidelined. For instance, the men folk had their lunch and dinner first, and then the women and the female children would eat whatever was left. This kind of attitude that women were second in line was also obvious when important decisions had to be made in the family. Women were supposed to be in the shadows and not encouraged to voice their opinions. However, I did have one uncle who was very different from the crowd. He was more encouraging of women. He would say, hey, can I help out in the kitchen? And hey, why don't you all sit down with me when I'm eating and so forth. And one thing that was different about this uncle was that his wife was a working woman. And I wondered later on if the fact that he was different from the pack was because he was witnessing that his wife could also bring home something valuable, that she was also a human being, you know, a person in her own right, and not to be sidelined. So that, in part, led to this research.
Yeah, the idea that personal experience so much shapes how we think about our world. So, yeah, so how do you judge how married men think about women in the workplace?
Arthur is a co-author of mine, and so is Dolly Chug. When I approached Arthur, he pointed me to an archival data set here in the U.S. that records opinions about Americans on a whole set of dimensions, including gender issues. And he asked me to go ahead and examine the data set to see what was going on. Interestingly enough, in this data set, which is the General Social Survey data set, what I found was that those men who were married to stay-at-home wives, they tended to have more of a negative attitude towards the presence of women in the workplace. They tended to think that a woman should stay at home, raise babies, and take care of her husband's career, be supportive of him, as opposed to try and have a career of her own. So this was somewhat surprising to me because I thought that the U.S. would be different from India, for instance.
Let me just go to Judy Shen-Fillerman for a second. I saw you nodding there. Does this surprise you, the findings of the study?
Well, I think in terms of what it doesn't surprise me is the fact that we really all have particular cultural habits and ways that we think. And indeed, what you just said, this notion of that our personal experience shape how we think, is that if you look at the demands of anybody at a very senior executive level, man or woman, you really need to have a full-time person at home to take care of the rest of the family. If you look at senior executives who are men, the majority of them are married, right? And senior executive women, there are more of them not married and married without children. So that's just interesting stats out there. But I think the reason I was nodding is because of that particular perspective, they start to think about what is relevant. Just kind of a little flip of that is when you look at the men who are in senior positions, these are for women that I have coached. And frankly, my days at corporate America where I've had a lot of my mentors, which are all senior men, by the way, Caucasian. And those that had daughters that were coming of age, coming to their 20s, you see quite a bit of change in the way they perceive the women that are working with them. I look at that as a real positive, but it could also really, again, talk to the fact that how we experience our lives affect how we think about others. And if we really believe at the end of the day that a woman is there to help us and to serve us, what does that look like when she becomes my peer at the very senior executive level? And one of the things I want to kind of build on this is that I also put women as responsible in this play, which is that if you look at, you know, the numbers out there, which is that more women are graduating from college, going to law school, it is all based on competency, how smart I am, how intelligent I am. And that serves us really, really well in the first 5 years of our career. As you get more and more senior, it is not about competency because you would not be there if you were not highly competent. What becomes really, really important to get to those senior, the upper third of the pyramid, is about your degree of influence. Can I influence you about opinions, which is not about competency of data? It's about, can I just convince you about something? And frankly, at the very senior level, it's really about, can I hang out with you? How do I feel if I'm with you? This notion of, can I be collegial with you? So some of the women that I'm working with and have worked with, it's this notion of how do you create personal relationships with those people that are in power and to not focus simply on the competency and the work at hand, but really establishing this kind of collegial relationship that, again, you know, we're all social beings. So if you're looking at the men playing golf, doing tennis, it's much easier to do that. You insert a woman in that mix, and it's challenging. So I think that is where some of the challenges really are in terms of this men-women paradigm.
We're talking about the workforce with a focus on women and what it will take to improve the working environment and working culture to get them to the CEO office. I want to get back to this question of a leaky pipeline because it is very interesting to me, like, what creates the leaks? How do you have, right, women who are 50% of the workforce and then about 15% of upper executives and then 3% of CEOs? Where are the leaks coming in? I want to play a clip from Sheryl Sandberg, another big person in the tech world. She's the Chief Operating Officer of Facebook, 2010, where she's talking about the reality of being a woman in a sort of high-ranking corporate leader world when there are so few others.
A couple of years ago, I was in New York, and I was pitching a deal, and I was in one of those fancy New York private equity offices you can picture, and I'm in the meeting. It's about a three-hour meeting, and 2 hours in, there's kind of needs to be that bio break, and everyone stands up. And the partner running the meeting starts looking really embarrassed. And I realize he doesn't know where the women's room is in his office. So I start looking around for moving boxes, figuring they just moved in, but I don't see any. And so I said, "So did you just move into this office?" And he said, "No, we've been here about a year." And I said, "Are you telling me that I'm the only woman to have pitched a deal in this office in a year?" And he looked at me and he said, "Yeah, or maybe you're the only one who had to go to the bathroom."
Lottie Balin from MIT Sloan. What's happening with the leaky pipe?
One thing that is not happening, and I thought you might play this, because my understanding is that one of the things she said is that there's an ambition gap, that women don't have the ambition. None of the data that we have confirms that. If you asked the MBAs or the junior managers, the women and men equally want to go to the top and to get top positions. And so what happens is that two things, the expectations of what you have to do that job, which are old-fashioned, are not keeping up with the times, and there still are those gender stereotypes and gender biases that exist. So those two things combined make it more difficult for women, and they may decide, as some men, if they had the choice, might decide that they'd rather do something else.
So you're saying, in a sense, we think of women as sort of opting out because they want to have kids. And I should say here that that statistics show that about two-thirds of married men in high corporate offices do have kids, but only about one-third of married women in high corporate offices have kids. So we always think sort of women opt out to have kids. But are you saying part of the thing is they're opting out because they're not getting anywhere, because they're not getting where they want to be?
They're being pushed out. They are unable to do the job that they want to do and that they know they have the competence for, given the conditions of expectations and assumptions, which in fact are probably not helping the work itself.
So one of the expectations we tend to have, I think, of CEOs is that they're always available, that they're always on tap. Does that make sense either for men or for women?
It makes no sense because it means that people get over-dependent on the higher-up people. They don't do anything on their own. There's no learning in that organization. And so it also leads to a sort of firefighting mode. People don't have to take the time to think out what they're going to do, how they're going to get it done. They're sort of waiting for somebody to tell them, yes, this is okay, or do it this way. So from the work point of view, it's not the best way to manage an organization.
Judy Schoenfelderman, last comment here.
I think in terms of what you're talking about, this leaky pipeline, there are two things going on. One is, and I think both men and women or organizations need to all take responsibilities. from the women's perspective, we know that we are not the best self-promoters. And it is also very clear that if you're going to get to the senior top third of the triangle, you've got to self-promote. Here's what I've done. Here's what I've done. Here's what I've done. And not, I was saying before, don't wait to be asked to the dance. I'm going to go. Here's what I want. Put your hand up. Take the risk. So what if it doesn't exactly work? We've got to be able to do that. Organizations, on the other hand, have got to see this as a real threat to their talent management, talent pool. And the opportunities they have is at every juncture from individual contributor to management to executive, what are they doing to help them get the sponsorship, which we know is critical. Two is, as you get to these senior positions, informal network, do I know you and how well do I know you outside of the meetings is critical. Are the HR folks, our senior executives, going out and making a point of meeting these talented young women and say, we want you here? And when we know that women in their 30s are going to have kids and are committed to having kids, then we have to start thinking about not just do we help them ramp down, how to get them back in a way that we know in a new configuration that they can still contribute their very, very talented capabilities, but in a configuration that works for a multitude of preferences.
Yeah, so we're not losing half the talent pool.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much. We've been talking about the future of women in the workforce, and I've been speaking with Betsy Myers, the founding director of the Center for Women and Business at Bentley, Judy Shen-Pillerman, principal and founder of DreamBridge Partners, Lottie Balin, professor emeritus at MIT Sloan, and I spoke earlier with Sridhari Desai, research fellow at Harvard's Kennedy School and an assistant professor at the University of North Carolina. Thanks so much to all of you.
Thank you.
And when we return, how careful are you about what you buy? How much do you think about the impact your purchases have on the environment or how your products are made? We dip into some fascinating research on how ethical consumers really are.
If you ask them in a survey, you know, do you support sweatshop labor? 99.9% of people will say no. But in terms of their actual behavior, we really have not seen a huge shift in how people buy.
Remember that you can find us online at wgbh.org/innovationhub, where you can download our podcasts. I'm Kara Miller, and this is Innovation Hub.